Ten Commandments today, big deal. So I thought I'd talk about them. And Rabbi Sacks had just a superb article on it. And so I'm going to be mostly channeling him. Rabbi Sacks, of course, is dead. Good man, very great man. He was the chief rabbi of Great Britain. So he speaks English fluently. And one of the things he was saying about the Sinai Revelation is it is unique in human history. What happened at Sinai, of course, is you had somewhere between 2 and 2.5 million people gathered at the base of the mountain. And God came down and spoke directly to them. That hasn't happened before or since. And he obviously is not a Christian or a Muslim, but he contrasted it to Christianity and Islam, where he says, for example, in Islam, God talked to a prophet. And everybody believes that prophet. In Christianity, he said, well, he didn't speak to the whole nation. He spoke to one guy who said he was the Son of God, and then 12 of his disciples. And this is where I gently disagree with Rabbi Sacks, because Yeshua walked the land for 3 years, and thousands of people saw his works. And then after his resurrection, thousands of people again saw him after his resurrection. So I'll gently disagree with Rabbi Sacks on Christianity. I do agree with him on Islam, and I do agree with him on Judaism. The fact that you had 600,000 men is the census, and you figure women and children and so forth, at least 2.5 million. So the fact that God shows up and talks to that many people directly is a big deal. And one of the things about it is, it, for Jews anyway, completely does away with the idea that this is somebody's cooked up religion. You know, like somebody looked into his hats and some copper plates or whatever. In other words, God made himself directly known, and so that there was no mistake about it. The other thing about it is God himself sets himself up as the king. And he is the one who gives you the framework for human life. Within that framework, you can have a tribal structure, you can have kings, you can have parliaments, you can organize yourself in lots of different ways as long as the government that you set up recognizes that God is the ultimate lawgiver. What that means is the laws of God become an umbrella, if you will, under which human law operates. And first nice thing about that is God doesn't have any ulterior motives. When you have a legislature or a parliament making laws, you've got the human element in there. And if you look at our legislature in Denver, or you look at our legislature in Washington, it's very obvious that there are lots of human interests involved in the making of laws, many of which are corrupt. That question doesn't exist with God, because God doesn't really get any benefit from this. If I make a law that says, if you don't pay your taxes, I get to take all your stuff. Well, God doesn't need your stuff. So the idea that somehow this law is set up in a self-serving way is a non-starter. And that's what makes God's law unique. And I'll read a couple of passages from Sacks. This is Rabbi Sacks. So Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who was a French philosopher, wrote, "The Jews provide us with an astonishing spectacle. The laws of Numa, Lycurgus, or Solon are dead." And by the way, I had to look those guys up too, so I'll tell you who they are. Numa was the second king of Rome, and the one that set up the Roman system. Lycurgus was the lawgiver of Sparta in ancient Greece. And then Solon was the lawgiver of Athens in ancient Greece. So he's talking about the laws of Greece and Athens, which, of course, people in the West hold in high regard. So anyway, "The Jews provide us with an astonishing spectacle. The laws of Numa, Lycurgus, and Solon are dead. The very much older laws of Moses are still alive. Athens, Sparta, Rome have perished, and no longer have children left on earth. Zion, destroyed, has not lost its children. What must be the strength of legislation capable of working such wonders, capable of braving conquests, dispersions, revolutions, exiles, capable of surviving the customs, laws, empire of all the nations to last as long as the world? Any man, whosoever he is, must acknowledge this is a unique marvel, the causes of which, divine or human, clearly deserve the study and admiration of the sages, in preference to all that Greece and Rome offer. What he's saying, obviously, is that law works. Everything else is subject to change. We probably ought to study that law to find out why it works so well. So the first thing that God's laws do is they establish that human government has limits on what it can do. I'll read again from Sachs. Individuals were empowered to disobey illegal or immoral orders. The first example was the Hebrew midwives, who feared God and did not do what the Egyptian king had commanded. Another key moment was when King Saul ordered his servants to kill the priest of Nob, who had given David shelter. But the king's servant would not rise a hand to strike down the priest of the Lord. In other words, the king's servant recognized this is an illegal order, we're not going to do it. Now, he did find a rascal who would do it, but his regular servants wouldn't. They disobeyed the king. It was on this tradition that Calvin, inspiration of the 17th century Puritan radicals in England and America, drew when he said, prophets and teachers may take courage and thus boldly set themselves against kings and nations. And this, by the way, is contrasted with every government's favorite passage, which is Romans 13, which says you've got to obey the government. And what the Hebrew Bible says and what the Puritans and Reformation said is, yeah, except when those laws are contrary to the laws of God. Then you don't have to obey them anymore. And in fact, you have a duty not to obey them. Continuing reading in Sachs. It was the same tradition that Thomas Paine based his pamphlet Common Sense, widely credited at the time as the inspiration that led to the American Revolution. Historically, it was the covenant at Sinai and all that flowed from it, not the Greek political tradition that inspired the birth of freedom in Britain and America, the first people to take that road in the modern age. I got a son-in-law who's a lawyer in Boston. Good guy. I'm not throwing rocks at him. He and I went round and round this past summer because he's a big student of Greece. And he very, very into Greek philosophy and all that kind of stuff. So we got into an argument about what the source of good is. And he says, well, you know, common human decency. And I kept hitting him, by what standard? He said, well, you know, what it takes to be a good person. By what standard? I was harassing him, obviously. And the point I was making is the standard is God's law, not human tradition, which is what he was looking at. And by the way, I emailed him a copy of Sachs's article. And I said, apropos of what we were talking about this summer, and he sent me a nice note back. He says, as a matter of fact, I went with a client to New York for a memorial for Rabbi Sachs. And I will read that article with great interest. But anyway, the point is, human law is not absolute. God's law is absolute. And so what was said at Sinai when God established his relationship with Israel is you guys can organize as tribe, you can make a parliament, whatever, but understand that my law is over it all. And when your laws conflict with my laws, which happens with human beings all the time, my laws govern. And the whole idea here is, in fact, I'll read it to you again. Standard works on the history of politics of freedom trace it back through Marx, Rousseau, Hobbes, to Plato's Republic, Aristotle's Politics, and the Greek city-states, Athens in particular, of the 5th century BCE. This is a serious error. To be sure, words like democracy, rule of the people, are Greek in origin. The Greeks were gifted at abstract nouns and systematic thought. However, if we look at the birth of the modern, at figures like Milton, Hobbes, and Locke in England, and the founding fathers of America, the book with which they were in dialogue was not Plato or Aristotle, but the Hebrew Bible. Hobbes quotes 657 times in the Leviathan alone, long before the Greek philosophers, and far more profoundly at Mount Sinai, the concept of a free society was born. It's a brilliant article. I recommend you go read it all by yourself. So, 3 points that he makes in his article. Point number one is human law is not sovereign. God's law is sovereign. And human law that violates God's law is null and can be resisted. Point number two, the consent of the governed. Let me read you from what we read today in Exodus. I'm in Exodus 19:3. Moses went up to God. The Lord called to him out of the mountain, saying, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the people of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my commandments, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the people of Israel." Notice he says, a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. They don't have a king. So if you're going to be a kingdom and you don't have a king, who's the king? God. In other words, I am the king, you are my kingdom. If you agree. If you agree. So the first thing is, says, go make them this offer. Then down to 19:7. So Moses came and called the elders of the people and set before them all the words that the Lord had commanded him. All the people answered together and said, "All that the Lord has spoken, we will do." And Moses reported the words of the people to the Lord. So God made the people of Israel an offer. The people accepted it. At that point, we then have the Ten Commandments. In other words, the Ten Commandments don't start before the people have agreed to the covenant. So that's where we get in our Constitution and our Declaration is the consent of the governed. We get it straight from Sinai, because God himself did not impose his own rule on the people without their agreement. One of the things that that says is that people are not chattel, which is to say, you are not the property of the government. Now, governments also have to deal with the fact that human beings sin. And so government has to have laws and all that kind of stuff to deal with human perverseness. Nothing necessarily bad about that, depending upon whether or not those laws and that behavior are in accordance with the laws of God. But the whole point here is government doesn't own you. You are in a covenant with God. You consent to be in a government. And by the way, one of the things in the United States is if you decide you do not consent to this government, you can pick up your truck and move. Other countries, you can't do that. For example, during the Soviet Union era, in order for somebody to leave, they had to pay an exit tax. And they had to get permission from the government to leave. It's not the case here. I haven't checked recently, but that didn't used to be. You can pick up if you don't like it, and you can move to Venezuela if you want to. Actually, Chile or Argentina right now is a better place than Venezuela, but you get the idea. The whole deal is you are not the property of the government. Now, don't get me wrong again. You were born here. So by default, you're an American. You can choose not to be, but if you don't choose not to be, you are. So legitimate government has to be agreed to and not imposed. And one of the things that goes with that is our Declaration says, when the ends of the government cease to serve the needs of the people may alter or abolish it. You know, Jefferson was a hippie, but he had a good turn of phrase. And the whole point is, if the government is not doing what you want to do, you, the people, have the right to alter or abolish it. And then the final thing Sachs talks about is this covenant is with everybody. All the men, the women, and the children. Everybody in the nation is standing at the foot of the mountain. So it is not just the case that it is a covenant with some special group. So for example, going back to Athens or Sparta, they invented democracy, but everybody didn't get to play. The only people who got to play were the warrior class. If you were a woman, a child, a slave, a stranger, anything like that, you didn't get to play. God, on the other hand, when he comes down on Sinai, gets everybody in the nation there. So the idea is the covenant was with all of them. And by the way, that's the origin of our women's suffrage. And it didn't happen until the 19th century. In fact, in the 20th century, some states in the United States still didn't have women's suffrage. So the idea here is that flows from Sinai. Everybody is part of the covenant. Everybody has to consent. Everybody is, I don't want to say the same because you're not, but everybody in the eyes of God is of similar value. All men are created equal. It's a great turn of phrase, but it isn't true. Civics 101. When Jefferson wrote the Declaration, this idea that all men are created equal was against nobility. One of the things that he wrote someplace else is it is not the case that some men are born with saddles and other men are born booted and spurred to ride them. So what he's arguing against there is a hereditary aristocracy. He's not saying everybody's the same because they're not. So I was also listening to Ron Dart this week, who's, as I've said many times, the only Christian radio I listen to anymore. And he said something very interesting that dovetails with what Sachs said. And he said, I have lost faith in the jury system. And by the way, this was 10 years ago, because he's been dead for a while. But if you look at what's been going on with the justice in air quotes, department, and what the courts have been doing to people who are politically contrary to the current regime, you will lose faith in the jury system also. The jury system was intended to be a bulwark against tyranny. The way it was set up in the English system and the early American system is that in order to be convicted, you had to be convicted by a jury of your peers. Thing one. Thing two is the jury was empowered to judge both the facts of the case and the law under which that case was brought. Classic example, there was a fugitive slave law before the Civil War, where the Southerners said, all right, these people are property. If they flee to your part of the country, you got to send them back. That's the law. It was a federal law. Juries in the North refused to convict anyone under that law. Because if you read the Torah, what it says is if a slave flees, you shall not return him. So the jury said, yeah, these people are guilty of harboring slaves, but the law is unjust, therefore we will not convict. That's the strength of the jury system. That's what it was designed to do, as a bulwark against tyranny. However, it also depends on a moral and an educated people. And what we have now is not quite that anymore. Picking a jury is an art. The two lawyers on each side negotiate and so forth. But in the case of a grand jury, that is a creature of the state. Let me say this so it's clear. You have a trial jury, which in normal case is 12 people. That one, the two attorneys get to argue about and say, no, you can't have him, or yeah, so forth. So that's called voir dire. There's also a grand jury, which is the creature of the state, and the opposing lawyers don't get to choose that. And so what we have going on in this country now is prosecutors are assembling grand juries of people who are either dumb as bricks or highly partisan. What a grand jury does is indicts. So a grand jury says, all right, that guy's a bad guy. You need to arrest him and bring him in for trial. They don't try the case. They indict. So what the prosecutors have been doing in New York and Georgia and lots of other places is they've been impaneling grand juries that are stacked, either with stupid people or with people who are political activists in the direction they're interested in. And so now you get all of these indictments that flow down. And as Ron Dart says, he's lost faith in the jury system. And in his case, and I agree with him, we are no longer generally civically educated and moral according to God's word. And that's what the jury system depends on as it was originally set up. That's why it says a jury of your peers. Last thing we'll talk about is where we are today. One of the things that has been growing since probably the 18th century and has now reached full bloom is this idea of secularism. When the United States was set up, and Great Britain at the same time, it was set up by a Christian people. And the people who set it up were Christian people who were educated in Scripture. They were bright people. Most of them homeschooled, by the way. It's our First Amendment, which says, government shall not establish a religion or prohibit the free exercise thereof, right? Well, that has come to mean government has become hostile to religion. As originally set up, that was not what was intended. What that was intended to be is the federal government could not set up a state church. Individual states were free to do so. So, for example, the state of Connecticut, I believe, had a state church, the Congregational Church. Pennsylvania had a state church, the Quaker Church, supported by taxpayer money and all that kind of stuff. Perfectly constitutional, no problem. What was unconstitutional was the federal government establishing one. What that has devolved into is government hostility toward religion. And all law is somebody's idea of what's right or wrong. If nobody cares, there's no reason to make a law. Thou shalt separate thy trash, the glass from the paper. That's somebody's idea of something that's good and right. Thou shalt not murder. That's God's idea of something that's good and right. Thou shalt stop at an octagonal red sign. That's somebody's idea of what's right. And by the way, that one's benign. I don't have any problem with that. Separating my trash, I'm not so sure I like, but whatever. And the question then becomes, whose morality is going to be legislated? Now, our dear governor, one of the first things he said when he was inaugurated is, you Christians need to leave your religion at the state house door. You're going to come in and talk to us. You leave your religion outside. You don't bring it in here. Freshly stated that. Well, what that means is you cannot cite God's law as the reason why the law you want to pass is good. What that means is somebody else's law is going to be passed. So we have, for example, the state of Michigan right now is flirting with Sharia law because they have a very heavily Muslim population. So when people say, well, who's God and who's law? The question you have to ask, first off, is, do you believe in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? Then it's his. The second thing that question begs is, well, whose law is going to govern? The only reason that they are able to ask that question here is because this place was set up according to the laws of God. If this place had been set up according to the laws of Sharia or the laws of the Soviet Union or the laws of Chinese communists, you would not be able to ask that question. The infrastructure here is Christian, and all of these stupid arguments, who's law, who's God, all that kind of stuff, are only possible because of the Christian infrastructure that was set up. So when somebody says that to you, point that out to them, because they are being either duplicitous or they are ignorant. Ignorance can be fixed, duplicity is kind of hard. So recognize where you came from. Recognize that you do not have to obey laws that are contrary to God's law. Now, don't get me wrong, there may be consequences to that. You may have a SWAT team show up at your door. I'm not suggesting that there won't necessarily be consequences. But what I'm telling you is, from a moral and ethical point of view, if it conflicts with God's law, it is no law. Do with that as seems good to you.